Whether you call them wheels or orbs or discs or flying dragons, there are 500 or more cases in this new book, Wonders in the Sky by Jacques Vallée. And it's amazing as you read these cases how often these things seem to appear to what we would call great people, a pharaoh, the Chinese emperor, Alexander the Great, Michelangelo, and even to Jacques Vallée himself. You will have to wonder as well if that's on purpose, if it's some sort of a display. We'll get into that with Jacques Vallée as soon as we come back after this break on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us. We're talking with Jacques Vallée about his new book, Wonders in the Sky, and it's amazing the descriptions of different craft and objects that are seen in the sky over these 500 cases and hundreds of years. A case from 1752 in Russia about someone who was abducted in a, quote, flying cauldron. Another one from the same year in Norway of a flying octagon. One from 1745 London, a flying trumpet, and 1748 Scotland, globes of light. All kinds of different descriptions. And what amazes to me, as I teased a couple of minutes ago, how many of these cases involve great leaders, great people from history, a pharaoh, a Chinese emperor. Alexander the Great had one or more instances. Michelangelo, as Jacques mentioned, and Jacques, I should say that you've had your own case. Do you think that that is an accident, that these things appear to what we would call great people?
Well, I think it's simply the filter of history, that if it appeared to some peasant somewhere, probably the person would not have been able to read and write in those years. And the ones that come to us because they appeared to a king or to a pharaoh or to a bishop, were recorded because he was surrounded by scholars and clerks and people who could write. I think those are the ones that have survived and were felt to be important.
I should point out that although you've written a lot of UFO books, you are by no means a UFO believer, not in a classic sense. I mean, you believe there's a legitimate phenomena there, but you have really put it to the mainstream UFO community over the years, suggesting that some of their central theses are flat out wrong. You know, we, as you have said, we don't exactly know what it is, this intelligence, but you were the first to write that probably the vast amount of these incidents and cases belie the theory that the ET explanation is the best explanation, that it just doesn't seem to make sense. In looking at these 500 cases from years gone by, did they affect your views in that regard? Did they alter your views about what it might be?
That is obviously was a frequent topic of discussion between Chris Solbeck and me. He has a more detached, I think, view of that. He should speak for himself. But in my, my interpretation of his position a little bit more cautious. What I'm criticizing is the first degree, the first level ET explanation. I mean, that these are spacecraft that come from some other planet and they come here to save us or to conquer us or to steal materials from us and so on. I mean, that is the first thing you can think of when you begin to study this material. And I, the first two books I wrote back in the 60s, in the mid and late 60s, took that approach, and it's always, as I said, we know that there must be life equal or superior to our consciousness, to our intelligence, throughout the universe. It's a big cosmos out there, and I studied astronomy, and I still love astronomy, and now we keep discovering new planets, including planets similar to the Earth, so that only reinforces that view that was controversial in the 60s, but now it's mainstream. It's about time. However, when you look at the patterns, which as a scientist, a theory is only as good as the explanations that it provides for the facts. And when we look at the observations themselves, it doesn't account for what people are reporting. People are not reporting a spacecraft. They're reporting a whole range of phenomena, and there is no simplistic explanation. And if anything, doing this work in the last 6 years on the ancient sightings has sort of nailed that for me, that there is no simple explanation. It's not, you know, chariots of the gods. You know, it's not something like that, as seductive as it could be. However, that doesn't mean that they are not from outer space, or that form of consciousness doesn't have a link beyond the Earth. I mean, if they can do, they, you know, in the hypothetical they, in quotes, they can do what the witnesses described. That could be from anywhere, anytime. They have obviously mastered gravity. They have mastered time beyond what our science can account for today. Now, I'm a strong believer in science. I think science eventually will understand all this. I could be wrong, but it's not a simple spacecraft where you can just go there and kick the tires. At the center of any theory about UFOs, whether it's a paranormal, parapsychological, Jungian, and so on, you have to account for the fact that there is a machine there. There is a technology, and I've never said otherwise. That's really why I continue to be interested. I mean, I'm very interested in the physics of it. In my current work, I've narrowed down my work to just a few cases that involve traces, involve material, involve electronic communication, things that we begin to can make sense of in a somewhat primitive way. But we've collected, there is material that has been recovered after some of the close encounters that we can analyze. We're beginning to find some patterns in the physics. We're beginning to have some ideas about the electromagnetic communication, or at least the electromagnetic phenomena that surround these things. And little by little, we're converging on a pattern, or at least not an understanding yet, but at least a model of what that technology can be. But it's not all there is. There is much more than just technology involved, and that's what you see in, these ancient Chinese writers and poets were talking about a machine. They were talking about a contraption of some sort. And there were descriptions of things crashing to the ground. There were descriptions of traces. There are descriptions of medical effects, paralysis, intense heat when the object flew over them. Certainly medical effects and certainly psychological effects that are similar to what current witnesses, modern witnesses, are describing to us.
You know, you are familiar, of course, with this ranch in Utah where we've written something about it. And these different phenomena appear to different people at different times. It seems like whatever it is, it decides when it's seen, where it's seen, and who gets to see it. Almost as if it's a display, a show. In your writings over the years, you've written that it seems to be, one theory being, that it's almost like a control system, that whatever it is, it keeps us under control in ways by appearing at different times to different people. It, in effect, intervenes in the course of human affairs. And you have said that this control system theory that you have is testable. And I'd like to know if you ever tested it. And if not, is that still doable?
Well, I didn't mean necessarily that there was an intelligence, a supreme intelligence controlling it or directing it. The phenomenon has the information characteristics of a control system. It comes in waves. It responds to certain things. I've never published this, but I will someday. As you know, one of the things I want to leave behind is a record of my own research called Forbidden Science, and I've published two volumes so far, and they are not widely published, but they are on record, and I want to continue to do that. In the 90s, I tried to create sort of an artificial thing like the ranch in Utah. And this was, of course, before the events at the ranch. I tried to create a hotspot of information where I was hoping to sort of attract the phenomenon to be able to record it better. And it didn't give the results I was hoping for. It's not something that you can just decide to engage with, or at least I haven't found a way to do it. But it's worth continuing to try, because there seems to be a form of consciousness behind it that is extremely subtle, has a great sense of humor, is completely ruthless. I mean, I know from reading your book, you know, and actually being there, what happened at that ranch. There is no simplistic explanation.
And not just at the ranch, in general, across the world. I mean, this thing is it toys with people. It messes with their minds, and you always have to wonder what the heck kind of agenda is going on here, if there is even an agenda at all.
Well, you know, I studied physics, but I certainly don't consider myself a physicist. I'm trained in information science, and in information science and logic, you often have situations, well, even in mathematics, where you have contradictions in the material you're looking at. And the solution is to go up a level. It's not to fight it and try to force it into a preconceived idea. It's certainly true in mathematics. That's why, you know, imaginary numbers were invented. There are no imaginary numbers. But when you invent the concept, it enables you to do things in mathematics about real things that you couldn't do before. So I think that's probably what we will have to do with this, is go up a level, not be so fascinated by the, you know, the day-to-day cases and the sightings and the databases, which are, of course, you need to do, but you need to go up and take a wider view of this. And I think that's very much what the direction that Chris is going. Chris is going to write, you know, many more books. He has amazing material in many areas of this, and he'll continue to publish it, I hope. One of the remarkable things in this book is when you get to the 17th and 18th century, you get to the Enlightenment. And then you find that the witnesses are astronomers. Some of the greatest names in science, Arago, Messier, you know, the discoverer of what is now known as galaxies, the Messier objects. Cassini, the director of Paris Observatory. Of course, Arago was director as well. Le Verrier, who discovered Neptune. All of them were involved in this, in looking, actually inviting people to send them observations of unknown objects in the sky. The science was open. It was, in those days, it was great glory for an astronomer to attach his name to a new phenomenon. And scientists were completely open to the idea of this correspondence between astronomers and the mathematician Gauss, for example, about objects that were very puzzling to them. There are descriptions by Lagrange of a series of objects moving through the sky in military fashion and turning together. And those were not just, you know, a train of meteors. Cassini made two observations of something that seemed to be in orbit near Venus. And he didn't publish, these were careful scientists. He didn't publish it because he was the only one who had seen it. And he only published it when he saw it a second time a few years later. Now, these are careful men who've attached their name to some of the, you know, the great discoveries of the 18th century, and there you are. I mean, these are the records that we have forgotten, and when you see the academic arrogance that we encounter today of people just not even wanting to look at the records, even the records from pilots or records from the Air Force or from the Navy, they just won't even look at it. They will dismiss it with, you know, out of hand, with ridicule. The science has fallen to a terrible level of arrogance.
And of course, as you know, today, these days, the critics, the ultra skeptics and diehard debunkers, they like to say that no scientists ever see this stuff, astronomers never see this stuff. And it looks like we've gone backwards instead of forwards, at least in this regard, from the days of the Enlightenment that you describe in this book.
Yes, absolutely. It's a shame.
And scientists today, it seems like there's a gap between what the religion that they have embraced and what and the reality of what millions of people around the planet see. Now, of course, as you know, 90-95% of what people see in the sky is explainable, but that other 5% gets dismissed altogether, and nobody wants to hear about it. Don't even want to look at it.
Well, and that's, I think, culturally very dangerous because people know that. So they, you know, if a an educated person sees something in the sky, they don't want to be laughed at by some astronomer who's going to ridicule them or dismiss them. So they don't report it, or they, you know, hopefully they will report it to someone like me or somebody who's been publishing research on it or contact some of the UFO groups. But most witnesses today just keep it to themselves.
I do want to say you mentioned your two-volume work, Forbidden Science. I had read the first volume some years ago, and then last year when I saw you, you were kind enough to give me a copy of the second one. And if people want to understand, I know this is not a book for the masses. It's sort of your personal journey of discovery. But if people want to understand how Jacques Vallée came to sort of where he is now and is thinking about these subjects, this is what you need to read. Forbidden Science, Volume 2 is just an excellent book. And really, I'm surprised how candid you are about some of your thoughts and sharing your personal life with the readership.
Well, I think it has to be in the context of, you know, the researcher's own path. In a way, this is also, you know, a spiritual journey for me. And I feel, you know, honored to be able to work on this with a small cadre of people, of scientists and of researchers, of investigators like you, and try to make sense out of it. It's the greatest mystery that has been presented to us. And again, at the center, there is, I don't disagree with Leslie Kean or with Richard Dolan. I mean, he was kind enough to ask me to write a foreword to his first book. I don't disagree with their position that there is a technology there. The question, I think what I'm trying to contribute is the sense that there is no simplistic explanation. We shouldn't just jump to conclusions about this.
You are a skeptic in many regards, and in this book, Wonders in the Sky, you take on a little bit Eric von Daniken, Zechariah Sitchin. I mean, I would imagine at some point, as you're looking at 500 cases from antiquity on up, that you had to cross paths with some of the same cases and incidents and evidence that these guys have interpreted in their own way, right?
Yes, I also crossed paths with Alexander Kazantsev in Russia, who was one of the originators of all of that. There we get to an area where I'm not really competent to speak, you know, cultural anthropology and so on, and the history of religion. Chris and I, the book is in three parts, and what we've been talking about is the chronology itself, which is the first part, the largest one. But the second part looks at the cases that we've rejected, which includes a lot of cases that are in the UFO literature and, you know, have to do with chariots of the gods and all those interpretations, many of which we dismiss because, again, it's a simplistic explanation. Of course, the gods can do anything. They could, you know, they could come down here. But again, what the material we have doesn't reflect that kind of thing. It doesn't fit that theory. And a theory is only as good as what it explains, you know. And at some point, you have to take a skeptical, not a cynical, but a skeptical view of it, and really dig into the material and ask. You know, try to explain it fully.
Skeptical is a good word. It's just been hijacked in our time, Jacques. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of our fascinating interview with Jacques Vallée, author of the new book Wonders in the Sky, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Jacques Vallée, we've covered some of the highlights of your, I guess it's close to 60 years, 50 years that you've been chasing the UFO mystery and trying to figure it out. I wonder if this thought has occurred to you. You know, a few people have been at it as long as you or have done as important work. Whether or not it will be ultimately frustrating for you if you don't have the answers, during your time here. If you can't resolve the mystery in your mind, that's got to drive you crazy.
No. Science is never finished. I had the privilege of working on a new phenomenon, or something that wasn't commonly recognized, and of making a contribution to it, calling it to the attention of people. I think I work every day with physicists and with doctors, with medical people who've been working on, cancer for 60 years, and we still can't cure cancer. We're making progress, and there are new theories and new hopes. The same thing in physics. I mean, we still can't reconcile relativity with quantum mechanics, especially with respect to gravitation. You have to realize that these are difficult problems, and they take time. And we you're a worker like any other worker. You're never finished, and hopefully you make your contribution. You bring a little. I've seen during my career. I also had the privilege of working with some of the pioneers of the internet, with people like Paul Barron, who invented packet switching, people like Doug Engelbart, who did arguably the first social network at Stanford Research Institute, where I was in the 70s, and I've told those stories. It's not finished. I mean, we still don't know what the ultimate, we're just at the beginning of the internet and the web. We don't know what form is going to take, in 20 years. But the pleasure is having brought a few stones to the edifice. We're building something here. It's also a lot of fun. I think Chris and I were carried forward by, and the whole team, by just these extraordinary discoveries that we were making, including things that turned out to be, to have been invented completely by some, spurious author, where we could finally prove that the thing never happened. Things that turned out to be comets that had been quoted in the UFO literature for a long time. It ties to history, it ties to genealogy, it ties to a lot of extraordinary things. So, for example, the first congressional hearings on UFOs took place on December 15, 1813. Some ufologists keep calling for congressional hearings. Well, they happened in 1813. There were lights seen over the shore of Connecticut. And, of course, there was a war going on between the United States and England and the colonies in England in those days. And the question was, what were those lights? Was it created by traitors signaling to the English fleet? And there were very intense hearings and arguments in Congress about these unknown lights in the sky. And I think Decatur was involved in those discussions and so on. So you learn a lot about the history and a lot about culture as you go through this.
And amazingly enough, Congress did not resolve the mystery of the unexplained lights back then or in the 60s.
Exactly. They don't seem to be doing a very good job of explaining it.
You have also jumped in headfirst, and on one level, I guess I should not be surprised, given your inquisitive nature, into another sort of cutting-edge phenomena, and that's remote viewing. We read a couple of years ago that you had done some training yourself, and I wonder if, I don't know how much you are willing to talk about that, but whether or not it has contributed to your understanding of the UFO phenomena.
Well, that's a whole other discussion.
And yeah,
we,
I know.
We could go into that at some point.
Okay.
I was at SRI actually before the remote viewing program started, or just at the same time. I was just in one of the computer departments working with Dr. Engelbart, who had invented the mouse. He had already invented all of that, so I can take no credit for it. But we worked together on the early days of the ARPANET. SRI had machine number 2 on the ARPANET. I don't need to tell you how many millions of machines there are today on the Internet. And so those were exciting days, and the remote viewing project was just a few offices away. And many of the, quote, psychics, for lack of a better term, had seen UFOs. So I became sort of a friend of the cult or an advisor to the program, even though at the time I was not cleared for the program, but I had many contacts with the psychics involved. I was cleared later in the 80s, but when I was at SRI, when Ingo Swann arrived, I had many discussions at lunch with Ingo, and was absolutely fascinated with the things that he was doing and demonstrating. And we talked about I talked to him in terms of information patterns, because I deal with information, and in what it seemed to me that what he was doing was addressing information, except it was information that wasn't there, that was on the other side of the world, and transferring his consciousness in some mysterious way to those places. So I took him through a quick briefing or a course in information addressing from a computer point of view. And that's how the idea of coordinate remote viewing started. I didn't talk about it for a long time because when I was cleared for Grill Flame in the 80s, of course, this was a secret project. And I think I'm the only one who hasn't written a book about it. And by now, all of that, or practically all of it, has been declassified. So Ingo asked me to give a talk in Las Vegas a couple of years ago about those days, about the early days of the program, and I did. I think it's all over the Internet now. So I have no problem talking about it.
Did you ever use remote viewing, and as so many remote viewers have done, encounter some kind of intelligence or see a UFO while you're in that state?
I have not. I have experienced, I was trained by Ingo. I'm not a very good remote viewer, but I'm good enough to understand what it is and what you feel and what it does. I remember a case where I was given a set of coordinates and instantly I had vertigo, and I was on top of a peak somewhere with a precipice all around me. It turned out to be the top of a very, very high mountain, and that came immediately, and I'll always remember that. And I had a number of experiences of that type. I think if I have any talent, it's not remote viewing. It's probably in some other area.
We'll have to have you back for an entire show about that. I'll twist your arm with that. Let's talk about some current developments in ufology that seem to pop up year after year. I want to get your take on them. You and I had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing Phil Corso back in the 1990s. We talked to him here in Las Vegas and also saw him in Florida. And he, of course, he's a credible guy, an interesting guy who told an incredible story about recovered technology being salted out into private industry. What is your take, not necessarily just on Corso, but on the whole crash retrieval stuff that our government has pieces of flying saucers somewhere? Do we not have enough time for that? I mean, in general,
I can give you a quick answer. I don't want to evade the question as much as I'd like to. I was enormously impressed by Corso, by Phil Corso. I tend to be enormously impressed by anything who, saved Europe from fascism. And there is no question he was a brave soldier. Made it clear to us that he was a soldier, not a physicist. So he did not know really what these things were. Colonel Alexander, and he's publishing a book in a couple of months that includes a very, very detailed intelligent analysis of the Corso statement. So I would really defer to Colonel Alexander for that.
Okay.
Because he went through his military history, where he had been, why he said some of the things he said, and so on. My impression was that Phil Corso was telling us the truth as he believed it.
Well, let me ask it in a more generic sense. Do you believe that our military, our government, has pieces of a flying saucer that's from somewhere else?
Well, also said a couple of things that are impossible. For example, you know, about transistors. Well, I work every day with people. I mean, the invention of the transistor is within human memory. I work with people like Dr. Federico Fagin, for example, who is, you know, right here in Silicon Valley and was the inventor of the microcomputer, the integrated circuit. I mean, all of that, we know the people who did it. Many of them are still alive. They didn't get it from Roswell. You can trace that technology through all its extraordinary technology. It happened very fast, but physically it made sense. I mean, every step is understood. And we have their laboratory notebooks. We know how they made the discoveries, where every experiment went, and so on. And we're still, of course, developing that technology. So the idea that that came from Roswell makes absolutely no sense. The thing about fiber optic, well, it was known for a long time, even the 30s and before, that a wire of glass carries light. And in fact, it was used in art and it was used in instrumentation by glassmakers a long time before people thought about using it for fiber optic communication. So those things make no sense. I mean, the transistor was first described in the field effect in a German patent in 1934. So there is a continuity there in human memory and human technology. That's just development of technology. What intrigued me the most about Phil Corso was his encounter with an entity in the desert. And that was something he did not understand, that made a profound impression in his life. And it's not in his book, because the people who actually edited his book thought that that was a little bit too strange, and they wanted to stay within the dogma of, you know, crushed material and that kind of thing. The government, well, I don't know how, and there are people who do a good job of filing FOIA requests and digging into what the government must have known and so on, and about Roswell and other things. And I wish them well, and I'm glad that they have the
tenacity,
you know, the courage and the, you know, to do this. That's not something where I can contribute very much. I like to talk to, but you know, this is a phenomenon that's all around us. You can talk to farmers who've seen the thing close by on their field, and I can go talk to them, and that's what I like doing. And many of them want to be anonymous because they don't want to talk to the media, they don't want to talk to the Air Force, they don't want the government involved. But they'll talk to people like me and to researchers. And so we have access to the phenomenon, even to pieces of metal that are found after some of these, and we can analyze them and so on. So I like the, you know, this quiet Silicon Valley approach where you just do that work in stealth mode with your own resources. And I don't have the resources to do what should be done, which would be a larger scale study. So I concentrate on the things that I can do, which is looking at technology. Now, the government must have tons of records. We know that because we talk to pilots who say, when I landed, there were two guys there in blue jeans, and they confiscated all my material, and they took it somewhere, and they told me not to talk about it. So this must go somewhere. Now, it's not necessarily the CIA or the Air Force. We don't know where these guys in blue jeans come from. They violate many of the rules of handling of classified information. So who is it that can do that? I don't have the answer to that. I'm not so sure that it's a government agency, although we know, of course, that government agencies have accumulated stuff simply because they have sensors everywhere that are triggered by the phenomenon. So, of course, those people have classified clearances, and they can't talk to the guy in the next cubicle. So that's not the kind of research I can do. I'm not so hopeful that we can. I mean, obviously, the thing to do, and you know, I've said that time and again, this stuff should be turned over to science. And let science compete, let different labs and different teams come up with their best idea to do research on this in a competitive basis. I mean, that's the way the internet was built. That's the way we do research on everything else. I mean, what are they afraid of? What are they afraid of?
I guess ultimately they're not, you know, and it's, I wanted to ask you one more question, your view on disclosure, because Rich Dolan and Bryce Zabel will be here in the next, at the top of the hour to talk about after disclosure, AD. You believe that there is some sort of a storehouse of information, perhaps in government hands, perhaps in private hands, that could be disclosed. Do you think it's going to happen? I mean, is there any impetus? Anything?
When people talk about disclosure, that's not, they don't talk about my disclosure.
Right.
The question is, disclosure of what?
Yeah.
These are usually, the mainstream ufology today believes that the government has a proof of contact with extraterrestrials, including perhaps bodies or maybe live extraterrestrials. Well, how do they know that? You have testimony from credible people who say that there is something like that. So, yeah, let's track it down. But the disclosure that I'd like would simply be, turn the data that, strip it of any classified information. If it was a classified radar somewhere, I don't need to know how the radar works. But give us the data. Give us, just the facts, ma'am, and let science work on it. I don't think it's going to be very simple. It may take a couple of generations of scientists, but at least we will know. I mean, the public is not going to panic. In a case like this, it's the elites that panic because they're afraid of losing power. But the public, your audience, the people listening to us now, they can take it. I mean, they thought about this. Many of them probably have seen things themselves. They know there's something there. There is more than what we see every day, and around us. It's a big universe. So why are they so afraid?
Jacques Vallée, it's been wonderful to have you here. I sure hope that you will grace us with your presence again sometime, and wish you the best of luck. I encourage people to buy this book, Wonders in the Sky, and congratulate you and Chris Aubeck on writing it, because it's a fascinating procedure. And I hope this hasn't been too painful, and you'll come back and see us sometime.
It's a pleasure, and please give my warm regards to Richard.
I will. I will do that. Thank you very much, Jacques.
Thanks,
appreciate
Jacques.
It. Good night. And, we have looked at sort of the before with Jacques Vallée, these 500 cases from antiquity through the beginning of modern times. Next, after the break, after disclosure with Bryce Zabel and Rich Dolan, sort of the beginning, the before and the after. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Lots more to come. We're concerned as well about the direction our world is taking. And what would happen if the president called a news conference and announced that another intelligence, an alien intelligence, is here among us, interacting with humans, and perhaps have been here for a very long time, for reasons that are not exactly clear? What if the government was forced to make this acknowledgement because of some clear and convincing and inescapable event? How would our world change? What would be different in your life? Would we freak out? Would society collapse? Or would this usher in a new age of wonder? Historian Richard Dolan and writer-producer Bryce Zabel have pondered these questions in great detail and have produced a mammoth, thoughtful, and, in my view, immensely entertaining vision of what life would be like AD, after disclosure. Coming right up, I'm joined by Rich Dolan and Bryce Zabel to talk about what might be just around the corner. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Dolan is the author of the groundbreaking historical series UFOs and the National Security State. The first two volumes are out. I think he's working on a third one, looking at military encounters, government secrecy regarding UFOs. It's among the best UFO books ever written, in my opinion. And he's been on with me a couple of times here. He's well known to Coast audiences. His co-author of this new book, AD, is Bryce Zabel. And I hesitate to call him this, but I guess he's kind of a muckety-muck in Hollywood. He's was elected chairman and CEO of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. He's been an award-winning PBS investigative reporter, worked for CNN, has produced some TV series that you would know very well. I'm thrilled to have the both of them on here to talk about this new book. And, fellas, it's awesome.
Hello, George. Are you there?
Glad to have you here.
George, it's Bryce. It's great to be a part of any show that includes Jacques Vallée and also my co-author and friend Rich Dolan and yourself. Thanks for having us.
Hey, glad to have you here. Jacques sends his regards. He's a tough act to follow, fellas.
Tough act to follow, but I think he was a perfect act to follow. He set up where we've been, and we're here to talk about where we might be going.
Well, I finished your book today. I loved it. I'll have to tell you, there's a lot of impressive stuff in there, none more so than the comment right at the beginning from Stan Lee. He calls it a compelling look of history and informed speculation. How the heck did you get Stan, Rich?
Well, that was Bryce's connection there, so I'm going to let Bryce answer that one.
Okay.
Stan and I have known each other for years. I did a pilot with him back in the 90s for a television series, and then I helped him with his internet company a few years after that, and we've just stayed friends over the years. So one of the first people, let's face it, he's someone everybody knows. He's very well respected, and in fact, he talks about UFOs in detail in this book, his own feelings about how that might go down, and also he had a friend who had seen one up close and personal.
Rich, is there a describe the moment when you decided to launch this project? Is there an aha moment, an epiphany moment when you said, well, hey, we should write a book about after disclosure?
Yeah, you know, I've been wondering about that. I'm sure Bryce has some thoughts. Bryce, it was about 1 year ago at this time, in fact, that Bryce first contacted me to do some possible projects relating to my first two volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. And we had a bunch of conversations over the winter, and they sort of slowly moved into the springtime. And, you know, the next thing we knew, it was early spring, and we thought, we have a different project we could really talk about here. And we're both interested in the topic of UFO disclosure. We're both interested in speculating about how that might come about and what might happen in the aftermath. And it was in March, maybe early April, that we really just decided to floor it. And we were having a lot of phone conversations, and we thought we can not only do this book, but we can do it fast. We really got our thoughts laid out. This does not have to take 5 years of meticulous footnoting and researching. We pretty much know what we want to say. We can do some research, but we can also put this together and formulate it and throw it together. And that was in early April, I would say. Would you agree, Bryce?
Yes, and I have to say, Rich, it was pretty audacious to consider that you might put aside Volume 3 of your incredible trilogy to do this book. And part of the reason we decided to go for it, George, is that Rich is correct. We both said that this is something that has to be expressed. The sooner, the better. And it was time. And we both had independent thoughts about this for many years, and when we started comparing notes over the course of time, we just said we could do this. It won't be easy, but it can come together very quickly, and we decided just to go for it. And Rich is absolutely right. It was 1 year ago this week that we talked for the first time on the telephone. And
yeah.
So when you think about the life in television series, things can come together pretty quickly, but in books, not so quickly usually. So it is pretty, it's pretty unusual. And I'm glad that, Rich was game for it because we're very proud of what we have to put on the table here.
I'm amazed. Oh, go ahead, Rich.
I just want to jump in and just add that, when I, started letting the word out that I was working on this project with Bryce, I have readers who are so into, like, waiting for the third volume of my history, and I caught grief. They're like, well, that's really good for you, Rich. I'm glad you're doing this other book, but what about Volume 3 of your history? I said, look, this is fast. This is going really quickly, and we wrote this book. This is so crazy, but we wrote it all online. We did it on Google Documents. Anyone out there who wants to do a collaborative project, you got to look into this type of possibility in which you've got your, you know, your mail and you've got your calendar. We can do documents.
It was truly interesting because Rich is on the East Coast. I'm on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And the thing that we learned is that we began to trust each other very, very easily about letting someone take a first crack, letting someone write on top of it. And we just continued basically to write on top of each other and break new ground and rewrite and revise. And over the course of time, most of the book is something where it's a blended voice, where there are moments where you go, Rich and I were comparing notes a couple of weeks ago and saying, did you write that or did I write
exactly.
that? And we came to the conclusion that we both wrote it because we really couldn't remember where it started.
Yeah, it's difficult, and that's really the nice thing about the book. We really feel it was a true collaborative effort, and the result is something that we're both happy with, I think.
Well, here's my guess, Bryce, is that Rich Dolan did not make a great sacrifice putting aside Volume 3 so he could jump into this. I mean, I would guess that he is relieved to not have to be working on that for a while because this seemed like a lot of fun to write. I mean, you had a lot of fun with it.
Tremendous fun, and I would hate to speculate whether Rich had fun writing 1 and 2. I think he did, but they're an extreme research project. Each one of them, Volume 3, was probably going to be no less, and maybe more, and that they're just a lot of work and a longer turnaround time. And one of the things that we were able to do together is draw on some of the experience of ad and television, where you basically have to hit certain marks and certain deadlines to get your show on the air when it's supposed to be on the air. And we applied some of that same logic to this to just say, well, if we want to have this book out in the fall of 2010, then we better be here, in the middle of the summer, that kind of thing. And right. And it seemed to all pay off.
A lot of project management. We got it done.
And he's right. Google Docs was our friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's start this way. Both of you seem to have the opinion, and you express it in the book, that this is a when, not an if question. When disclosure happens, not if. And it's stated in the book in a couple of places, probably sooner than later. Rich, why don't you address that first, and then, Bryce, you take it on?
Thank you.
Absolutely. Look, one thing that I've been saying for years is that we are not in a holding pattern in terms of our time stream here. We're moving fast. This is not 1990. It's certainly not 1960. We're in 2010, and this world is moving in high speed. Look, YouTube has only existed for 5 years, if you can imagine that. Smartphones, about the same time. In other words, our ability as a civilization has to have a conversation with each other, to be able to get information out from the world and share that with each other, has just leapfrogged over itself over and over again. And obviously, we have to assume that the world is just not going to stop at a holding pattern in 2010 indefinitely. We're going to have a 2020, a 2030. What are we going to look like as a society at that time? It seems to me we're moving into an era in which the public's ability to force this issue is going to increase, not decrease. And it doesn't have to be that way. There are a lot of other variables in place, but I think we really need to consider this. Why does one think we're seeing UFOs in the news all over the place? It doesn't have to be because the powers that be are getting us ready. It could very well be. It's the opposite. They're trying not to let this out, but our own force as a civilization is forcing this issue out more and more and more. China is now in the game. They're seeing UFOs all the time because they're recording them just like we do over here in the West. So I think what's happening is that we're changing as a civilization, and we're forcing this issue out. And there's going to be a time, a day, a moment, an event in which something happens, and it could be a mass sighting that's multiply recorded from many vantage points that makes it irrevocable, something in which the powers that be are forced to make a decision to disclose. They're not going to do it because they want to. They're not going to do it because they love us and want us to move into the next density or dimension. They're going to do it because they have to stay out in front of this in order to try to maintain control of the spin. And that's when it'll start.
George, we thought, we say this in the book, but we said it to ourselves, that there are two competing ways to look at disclosure. First is it's impossible, and then that it's inevitable, which seem contradictory, but not really. If you think of secrecy, which has been in force for at least 7 decades, or almost 7 decades, think of secrecy as the immovable object. Well, what is the irresistible force? It's truth. And as Rich pointed out, we are technologically becoming more sophisticated with every year, and it's going to be harder and harder for the wired world that we live in, the highly sophisticated world that we live in, to not expose for ourselves, disclose to ourselves, even if our leadership won't step forward and do it first, disclosure is going to happen. In fact, some people could argue it's already happening, just that not everyone knows about it. So we think pretty clearly that the thing that used to be impossible will soon become inevitable, and secrecy will have to give away to truth sooner probably than later.
Yeah. You get into a couple of possible ways how it could happen, what could get it started. You look at this theoretical incident over a Canadian city, something that could not be denied, and a UFO hovering for a long period of time. Everyone sees it. So the president is forced to make an announcement. But you also talk about some other possible contributing factors. For example, an investigative reporter gets a leak about it and starts working on the story, which, of course, as you note, has happened in the past. A deathbed confession of some guy who was an inside player, which has also happened. Physical evidence, we think that may have happened. The head of a foreign state makes a statement. And, you know, all those things have happened to one degree or another. But it hasn't forced the hand of the U.S. government, which in your book you seem to say it's got to be us. It's got to be the U.S. government, the president, somebody here who makes that announcement for the whole world to accept it.
Yeah, I would say most likely that is the case. We did, Bryce and I explored the possible methods by which this would happen. And we really wondered about this and pondered. For example, a lot of them are very problematic, like a deathbed confession by some major public figure. We thought, well, that's possible, but really the more we thought about it, the less and less likely that one seemed to us to be the one that would be able to get enough traction, maybe in conjunction with something else. But you think about it, even an ex-president or some other major public figure, say a Colin Powell, you know, we wondered about, if he were to say, yes, UFOs are real, it's real, they're here, yeah, that might do it. But then again, you know, there would still be a tremendous amount of backlash against him by the other side in terms of discrediting him. So you never really know. You'd have to have a really strong case if you're a public figure. But all of these are possible. We feel if you're going to throw your money down and make a bet, mass sighting recorded with new technologies that the public is probably going to be getting online in the next few years. That's probably your best bet.
It's true, George, that many of the things that you just mentioned have happened to greater or lesser extents over the years. And we use those actually as our markers to try to determine what kind of precedent has been set. And it's all magnitude. But we also think that one of the things that is likely to lead to disclosure is not the only event that happens. It's some kind of precipitating moment that allows the tipping point to be reached, and then we sort of call it the avalanche, which is at some point almost all of the above that you were talking about start to come into play, where literally that irresistible force of truth has the power and force of an avalanche rolling downhill, and all you can do if you're managing a secret is to try to get in front of it rather than to try to stop it. And that ultimately is what we think is going to have to happen, that the people who are managing the secret are not going to give it up easily, but when they do decide they have to give it up because events are spinning out of their own control, what they'll try to do is manage it even as it goes public.
They have to. Look, the intelligence community, the powers that be, the elites, they're not just going to walk away once they're forced to reveal this, or once it just reveals itself. They're not just going to say, oh, yeah, well, we'll let the public now control all this information. Obviously, they're probably not going to want to do that. So, once it comes out, the new dynamic, I think, will probably have to be the battle over the domain of where truth actually is going to land here.
I definitely want to get into that. What I like most about the book, and there's so much in it to like, is how you weave informed speculation in with things that have already happened of this nature, examples where information came spilling out and big revelations and how society reacted. That's I think, one of the strongest parts of it.
One of the things, if you want to predict the future, you have to kind of look at the past and say, what kind of events are similar that we could draw some conclusions from? So we've tried to take in almost anything was fair game. How was Watergate handled? what about the pardon of the Vietnam war protesters who left the country? Those kind of things, pardons, truth commissions, amnesty.
South African Truth Commission.
Yeah, all of that stuff is where we can look for inspiration for how disclosure might be handled. But we do have to point out that Rich and I do not have a crystal ball. We don't know exactly how things are going to happen. We can only speculate, as you point out, informed speculation. But we did decide as we were writing this book not to be overly cautious. We decided that in order to do the contribution we wanted to this very topic and to help make the discussion continue in a more productive way, we had to be bold. We had to take some very specific stands. So instead of generalities, in many cases, we try to come forward with very specific examples of how things might work out. And that pretty much defines how we looked at the book from the beginning.
Yeah.
It opens with this presidential news conference, which sounds very much, Bryce, like you might have written that part as the as an opening scene in a movie, because it sure sounds like the beginning of a movie to me, what it would be like. Am I close to that?
Maybe it should be a movie. Well, we'll probably talk about this later, but the television series I did, Dark Skies, back in the 90s, if you think about it, was really all about disclosure and presidents. As Rich pointed out, they're the top of the top, so presidents are likely to be involved. But we don't even say that a president has to be the person who tells the news, even though we begin the book with that attitude. We're using it really as an example, because the truth is there are other ways that disclosure could happen outside of presidents. But to be very specific about your question, absolutely. Talking about how a president might speak to the nation about how disclosure would be handled is something that I've thought about a long time, and Rich has thought about it a long time too. But actually putting the spin on how the president might speak is something that I've been doing for a while, and we were happy to put that in the book too.
We had a nice division of labor in breaking the book down. As we were working on all the 10 chapters, we would have phone conversations just about every day. And it would be like this. Okay, I'm working on two. What do you got, six? Okay, great. You do that. I'll do this.
Yes.
We'll look that over later. And then, we would switch or we would add things to each other's. But, Bryce really, one of the things I loved about his contribution to this, in addition to his general thoughtfulness, is just the fact that as a person used to working in television, what he brings to this is this vivid, concrete ability that just put people right into the picture. Which really gives another dimension to this.
Understood. I think you guys hit the nail on the head when you said that this disclosure, if an announcement were made, it would become a where were you moment, sort of like JFK, sort of like man walking on the moon. We'll get into that and talk about what would happen in the first minute, the first hour, the first 24 hours, and the first year AD after disclosure with Bryce Zabel and Rich Dolan. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Rich Dolan, in the book that you and Bryce Zabel have written, you describe the entities, whoever they are, the other intelligence, as simply the others, and you sort of describe the idea that they could be extraterrestrials, they could be any interdimensionals, they could be any number of things or a combination of all the above. But in any scenario, I guess, to compel disclosure by the American government, the ball would have to be in their court, wouldn't it? Sort of?
Well, yes, maybe, and no, maybe. I'm not really convinced that even these others, and that's really the best word we can come up for them, that even they have all the cards, nor do the secret keepers have all the cards. As we've maintained, one of the big variables is ourselves and our own continuing ability to redefine part of the equation and being able to have a better conversation with ourselves, to be able to learn more, detect more. But certainly, whoever they are, they've probably been here a long time. That's what sure it looks like. They've been interested in us. In particular, I think they're interested in us right now at this point in our history, simply because of who we are and what we're becoming. So, they're part of the equation. And in fact, one of the most difficult elements of doing this book that Bryce and I had was because there's so many couple of important possibilities of what they might be and what their agendas might be, that obviously that's going to flavor the result of a post-disclosure world. And what we try to do is look at those various possibilities.
Yeah, if they're here to eat us, for example, that would not be a comforting message that the president were to make. Bryce, you you discussed some of the limitations on what the president might say. What do you think the most likely speech would involve, how much he could reveal? Obviously, as you discussed, there is a range of disclosures that could happen. Do you lean toward the least amount or the most amount?
Well, it's interesting. We believe that the way to look at this is to not overreach yourself and not create an entirely different world that the people who are going to go about disclosing anything, to the extent that they disclose anything, are going to do it by some of the rules that already exist. And one of the top rules currently is getting ahead of a story and also managing the spin of the story. So when you say that we don't want, when I say that we don't want to get ahead of the story, we also don't want to get ahead of saying that we know more than we know. There are people out there that probably have a great deal more information about what we're up against, about who's really here and what their intentions are, what their agendas are. We can speculate because there's been a lot that's been put out there, but some of it's disinformation and some of it's just wrong. And so to answer your question about what the president's going to disclose, first of all, that assumes that it will be the president that discloses, and that's certainly a very good possibility. But if some disclosure begins to happen in other ways, the president will simply be confirming. So there is always the possibility that the first thing any politician will want to do is to keep things limited, but at least to get out ahead of the story. The problem, of course, is disclosure is a little bit about like pregnancy. You can't just do a little bit of disclosure. Once you allow that, yes, we are being visited, and that not only are we not alone, but the people that are also out there are not cosmic pen pals that we're speaking to by radio telescope, and a message could take 50 years to get back and forth, but that they're here now, that pretty much opens the door to a lot of questions. And so I think the answer is, I think at the beginning, they'll try to maintain some kind of sense of, we can't tell you everything because there's still national security involved, but we'll tell you what we can tell you right now. And for at least the beginning, the public might be open to accepting that. But eventually the public is going to say, we want to know the whole thing. Tell us everything you know. And they'll probably have to fess up almost everything they know.
And, of course, you go into the idea of what questions would have to be asked and answered. And the main one that people would want to know is, are we safe? Are we threatened?
I come from a news background, and the thing that they drilled into us in journalism school is that the purpose of any broadcast, news broadcast, was to answer the question of, are we safe? It might be a national broadcast, in which case, are we safe is a national issue. Locally, it might be, there are burglars on the loose or whatever. The question is, are we safe? And I think people will want to know that. Rich and I talked about that at length, and we believe that the first thing people will want to know is, who are they and what do they want? And whatever the disclosure is going to be is going to have to at least take a stab at answering those two questions, because they form the core questions for the real question is, are we safe? And people will want to know, do I have to really fear for my family right now, or is this something that's more of an abstraction? And we honestly don't know the complete answer to that. Nobody really does, or the people that do know aren't talking right now.
Well, tell me this, Rich. Rich, could
that, the big dynamic in an immediate post disclosure scenario is going to be, first of all, we have to ask ourselves, how much can a president really be able to say? Put yourself in the position of being the person, the man or the woman, who's going to be telling the world that this is a reality. And what if you have just been briefed by Majestic what we call the breakaway group, the breakaway civilization, and they've told you some really scary things? you have to consider how this effect will play out worldwide in terms of politics, panic, financial repercussions, and so forth. And on top of that, even just logistically, physically getting access to all of the classified information that's there, buried in deeply clandestine special access programs that who knows how deep some of these things go. It would almost not even be possible physically for any person to give it all up right away, even if they did want to. And so really, I think the great dynamic in a post-disclosure scenario is going to be, just like Bryce said, you can't be a little bit pregnant. You can't disclose a little bit. And the public, maybe more quickly, is going to be saying, well, wait a minute, we have some other questions here, guys. The president just can't go up to the podium and say, or he can try, it's come to my attention that, yes, confirm that some of these UFOs, gosh, they are real. He can't then go on a six-month vacation, unfortunately, for him.
No.
People will ask some questions, certainly.
But we also think that the president, to the extent the president is speaking, is not going to want to get into all the minutia of it. The president will have to accept that they are the disclosure president, that when disclosure comes, whoever is on the job at that point, whatever their agenda was going into office, this is how they're going to be remembered forever and ever as the disclosure president. The other thing to keep in mind, George, is that quite likely any public official at the level of the president is not going to have known the whole truth until very, very recently before he has to stand before the assembled media and talk about it. Most presidents, and you know, you can go to Rich's excellent first two volumes and read up on what people think about what the presidents know or didn't know. It's been a mixed bag, but clearly the president of the future, who is going to have to be the disclosure president, will not have started with a great deal of knowledge. It seems unlikely that they would anyway.
I thought it was very realistic, your description of when it might happen, you know, a Friday evening after
right.
the stock market has closed,
right.
when the panic could not affect the markets and cause the economy to collapse, when people would have the weekend sort of to digest it, before the you know, before everything kicks back into gear. That seemed very realistic to me.
It's interesting that you pull that out, George, and thank you for doing that. That's one of the first things that Rich and I started talking about. And when I said we decided to throw caution to the wind, it's that kind of specificity where we ask ourselves, can we actually say this? And we said, well, it's our book. It's just our opinion, but let's do it. Let's make it that level of specific. So we actually kicked that around and asked ourselves, well, when would such a thing happen? And what would be the dynamics that would be going on in a meeting at the highest levels of governments about when one should do it? And clearly, panic is always something that people talk about. There's different levels of panic. There's also economic panic, and clearly it makes more sense to try to get this thing happening at, if it has to happen, and we talked about management of the news cycle. Don't let it happen when the stock market can react to it, and so we have gone out on a limb and said it's quite likely it will be a Friday afternoon after the stock market closes. Now, the media won't like that because they don't get to – the media likes a story served up early in the morning so that they can process it and begin the news cycle in the morning. But that's probably not what's going to happen because having the weekend for people to talk about it and assimilate it, and then for the people who are divulging the information to analyze how the public is taking it, seems like a pretty reasonable way to start managing this story.
Well, the media isn't going to like a lot of what happens in
no.
the scenarios that you describe, and deservedly so, and we'll get into that in a bit. Rich, I want to start with you in sort of in general terms, and then we'll get into some specific institutions and how they would react. What would happen in the first minute? What would happen in the first hour? What jumps out at you in those scenarios?
First minute, we're going to be dealing with a lot of people just utterly bewildered, shocked, almost trying to grab themselves by the seat of the pants, wondering, wait, is this absolutely real? You can't be telling me this is real. Disbelief, a lot of disbelief. I think that'll continue probably for the first hour. but what we'll start seeing, you know, cell phone calls. I mean, think 9/11, how the world reacted on that day, and I think we'll be getting something along the same lines here. People calling their family, people calling their friends, phone lines probably being pushed right to the max and beyond. Are you okay? Where are you? Get home. This type of thing. You know, people being called in home from work and so forth. Definitely, I think you can really see that. People going to their church or synagogue or temple during the first day. I think you can expect a lot of people getting together for religious worship and services. It's a day of really, I think, people coming together to in fear, in many cases, fear of the unknown, of what actually this all portends. And then I think really with the first week, you're going to start getting some questions, some serious questions. And this is where I think disclosure becomes a very difficult proposition for any leadership. People are going to be asking, hey, wait a minute, wait, disclosing. So all this time, you've been telling us UFOs don't exist, but they do, right? So how have you kept this secret from the world? What does that say about our society, that our political institutions, our journalistic institutions for the most part, our academic, scientific institutions, where have they been and why have they been out of it? That'll be a question. Then more serious will be questions about, you know, are you actually doing all these black budget programs like some people have been claiming, and where are they? What's the nature of them? Do you have secret technology that has been alleged that can do all kinds of advanced exotic things? Have and then it gets further. You know, have people been abducted? This will be one of the early questions I think that will be asked, because, look, after all, if you admit that there are other beings here interacting with us on Earth, suddenly all of these many claims of people who've been taken and acted upon by other entities, somehow now that doesn't seem so crazy. And there's going to be a lot of forward motion to deal with that, and that will not be an easy question, probably, for any political leadership to deal with. And the questions will simply multiply and accelerate from that point onward. There's going to be a very mixed reaction people have toward their military. On the one hand, they're going to be angry with the military for having been involved in covering up this information for all these years. On the other hand, they're going to look to the military, very probably, for protection, if need be, from whoever these other people have to be. If, in fact, we decide as a world that there's some reason to be afraid. And again, that comes down to how we're going to interpret who these other beings are. The really unsatisfying part of a post-disclosure scenario, I think as we were working this out, it really dawned on us, is that it really could be a very unsatisfying result, in that we may not have an awful lot more information about these other beings than we do now. You know, it could very well be a case in which we get to a point where we have enough information to prove definitively as a society that, yes, they're here. But it may not be enough to pull them down and put them at the podium next to the president during the press conference. And so proving who they are, what they are, what their agenda is, this may be another messy post-disclosure process that may not be neat.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes about one area that I thought was very fun and very telling, and that was the effects on media. And you had a lot of fun speculating in this area. And I'm just wondering, day two after disclosure, are Dolan and Zabel on Meet the Press? Do you guys become automatic celebrities, super celebrities?
That will be up to the media to decide. I'll tell you what what we both came to the conclusion is that the media doesn't have as much credibility today as it did certainly when this cover-up began. And the initial thing that people will realize when disclosure happens of any kind is that the media has been, and I'm a member of the media, have been, but they'll realize that the media was asleep at the switch and completely and totally booted this story. And so most institutions that suffer that crushing revelation of their lack of credibility would be destroyed. Interestingly enough, disclosure will probably be sufficient enough to that it could destroy the institution, and yet it will save media. Right now, media is struggling to try to figure out what its role in, is currently going to be and how to pay for itself, etc. The biggest gift that could ever be given to the media right now is disclosure. It will give them years and years and years of things to talk about, and watch how quickly the media will be able to pivot from the fact that they missed this story to the fact that they're covering it now. They'll cover their own missing of the story, and they'll do it shamelessly. And we will have no choice.
No sense of irony.
Listen to them.
Yeah, there'd be an hour special or a two-hour special, 60 Minutes or somebody doing the story on well, here's how we missed it and why, and people would be glued to the set to see it.
One of the most frustrating things today, for anyone who actually knows and senses what the reality of the situation is to just watch the how very much the media has bought into the official denial and public ridicule, and how that they don't need to be manipulated. They've already bought into this
voluntarily. Yeah.
The fact that those six Air Force officers were able to stand up at the National Press Club at the end of September and talk about how UFOs were sighted within a distance of nuclear missile bases and interfered with those nuclear missiles, and to have the media, the establishment media, completely ignore that conference, not even go, and then when they did cover it, to do so in such a ridiculous way, the Washington Post, the home of Woodward and Bernstein, rather than send a national security reporter to look into these allegations that UFOs had compromised nuclear missile bases, instead of doing that, what did they do? They sent a lifestyle reporter who went to the National Press Club and began and ended his coverage of this very important topic by talking about the kind of cookies that were served at the press club. That is just not going to make it after disclosure. People are going to be furious that the people who set themselves up to represent them and telling them the way it is and whether they're safe or not, as we discussed earlier, botched the job so badly, and yet there will be nobody else around to cover it, and so they're going to get a pass.
I thought the example you used in the book of Edgar Mitchell's statements, you know, Dr. Mitchell, sixth man to walk on the moon, he's been talking about UFOs and the UFO reality for a long time. He makes a statement a year or so ago that he really believes there is a cover-up, and suddenly he gets a bunch of coverage. What? What's this? News outlets around the world are somehow surprised that he's been saying these things, the same things he's been saying for a long time, and other astronauts like Gordon Cooper have been saying as well. We'll be back with more of our discussion of AD after disclosure right after this on Coast to Coast AM. I don't want to dwell too long on the media part of this, but it is the industry that we're in, and it's kind of fun to speculate. I thought that was some of the most interesting stuff that you guys included in the book, After Disclosure. And you speculate that there would be a whole new line of work for skeptics and debunkers who might suddenly see the light. I have a feeling that people would not only be mad at them, but the media in general, when they realize, as you note, that there's a whole lot of information that's been in the public realm that media have ignored. Rich, you want to take that one on?
Absolutely, they will be. The problem, though, is that media, like many of the other large institutions in our society, is not just going to wilt away in a post-disclosure scenario, no matter how angry the public is at these journalists. Now, one thing that I think will happen, I certainly feel we hope it will happen, I think it should happen, is that the public's going to be asking, now, if you've missed the story, why have you missed the story? You know, look, it's not that difficult. There are people right now who are already onto this, the connection of the media with, say, those people at the top of our food chain, the elites that they work with. The Washington Post, Bryce referred to the Post coverage of the National Press Club event a month ago. So inane, so ridiculous, and, you know, what does that represent? Well, certainly they made the decision, the Post, to send one of the most, light types of coverage possible, and they did that for a reason, because they work with the very establishment to manage this problem. They've always done. The Washington Post and New York Times have reliably, for decade after decade, worked hand in glove with the political elites and those managers of the political elites to keep this problem the way it is, low-key in the public's mind. And so they are going to be examined. And, you know, it's an interesting question to ask, how bad will the blowback against them be? But I don't think it's fair to say that they're just going to go away. They're an institution.
You're also right, George, about some of the debunkers that we currently hear a lot from will be doing some pretty amazing double backflips after disclosure to imply that they never really actually said that. What they really meant was,
yeah.
And you're going to see all kinds of people doing that. Part of the problem with the media has been just tonality also. You mentioned just before the break Edgar Mitchell getting a lot of coverage in the news, and it's true, he did get a lot of coverage, but what kind of coverage? In some of the CNN coverage I saw about Mitchell, they played X-Files music, they used loaded words like little green men. Instead of talking about UFOs, they talk about flying saucers, all the things you can do to sort of minimize and make that story feel small, when in reality, when Edgar Mitchell started saying the things that he was saying, the man should have been on the cover of Newsweek magazine and Time magazine, and those should have been lead kind of stories, or at least big investigative stories on Nightline, etc., but they never were. And you have to ask yourself, why is that the case? Partly, it is because of working hand in glove, but the other part of it is, and I've been in the media, and so I guess I've been guilty too, but people who are in the media want to be perceived as, it's like high school, they want to be part of the cool crowd, and they're just worried, deathly afraid, that they will be tarnished by the UFO subject and be made to feel less serious, and they just can't tolerate that. So while the same dynamic that works against decent coverage of the topic right now will completely flip over after the reality of ET reality, UFO reality is acknowledged, then you'll see the media giving this the same coverage they gave the Monica Lewinsky scandal and the Michael Jackson funeral.
You think that the military would be put on alert, that there would be martial law called for maybe all over the world, right?
Yeah.
Well, we think it's a distinct possibility. Clearly, when you talk about martial law, the question is, it's not that people are going to declare martial law because there's been disclosure. It will be what is happening as a consequence of disclosure. Does that require some kind of stepping in to try to keep the social order? And the thing that history, again, we always go back to history. What history has taught us is, in cases that it makes no sense for people to be looting, for example, they just start looting anyway because the social order seems to be breaking down.
And hoarding, too, right?
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, the hoarding actually is a really good point. Let's go back to the hoarding. What we are trying to make as a point here is that it isn't necessarily the news itself, it's the human reaction to the news that is going to cause a pretty bumpy first year. And a good example of that would be you have a disclosure of some kind. What's the natural human reaction, whether it's a hurricane that might hit your city or whatever? Everybody runs down to the Costco or the Walmart, and they buy everything they can get their hands on. Every battery disappears, water disappears, flashlights, etc. The same thing will happen after disclosure. There'll be a massive amount of hoarding. But what that will do is it continues kind of a self-perpetuating meltdown. Things disappear from the shelves. Well, what does that do? It isn't necessarily even the panic of the potential of who these others are that will be frightening people. It will be the fact that I can't get a gallon of milk delivered when I expect it to be delivered. What happens if the gasoline is not being delivered because some of the guys that are drivers go home to be with their families and they don't go to the jobs like they're supposed to? That becomes kind of a whole cycle of problems for people that have to be managed, and they are only sidebar issues to the fact of disclosure itself. It's what disclosure has triggered. So one of the things that we've tried to do in this book is just illustrate some of the things that are going to happen that are pretty much inevitable, hoarding being a great example.
I think there's this, you know, you have to address, and you do in the book, you have to address the possibility that social collapse, collapse of social institutions, that widespread panic would happen. It depends, I guess, Richard, on how the message is phrased, how the disclosure happens. But there are elements of our society that would freak out and around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, everyone has not everyone listens to Coast to Coast, and everyone has got family members who are not on the ball with these types of issues. We all have family reunions, right? Not everyone's going to be ready for this. And large numbers of people are going to react very, very differently to this news, much of which will be dependent, in fact, on their pre-existing belief systems, including religious belief systems. And so, yes, there is always a danger of real collapse. And, in fact, look, it's not unrealistic to say that this could happen, at least for a short period of time, and who knows for how long that would last. Neither Bryce nor myself, believe that this is something that will last indefinitely, simply because, you know, human society doesn't just collapse it into disorder permanently over things. People have to organize. People have to maintain themselves. The immediate reaction that a lot of people will have will be one of utter panic, utter fear. There's no question about it. I've had so many discussions with people in my personal life when they find out that I research the UFO topic in general. Some of them get very interested. Some of them get scared,
right?
Because they find out that there's a guy who seems to know a few things about it, who takes it seriously, and actually believes it's real. But here's the thing. There's only so long that you can pull your hair out and run around in circles in panic. At a certain point, you're going to have to deal with your family, and you're going to have to deal with the business of living. And so, you know, this immediate type of social collapse can't and won't go on indefinitely. The thing of martial law, I just want to add something to Bryce's very perceptive comments on this, which is that there's a large school of thought, at least in the UFO sort of alternative culture, that there will be a kind of a forced or faked ET invasion, and that will be the so-called event that will enable them to declare global martial law. I don't consider this realistic. It's our own opinion that this is really not the likeliest scenario. What we believe is that there are other beings here, that any announcement is not going to be a fake announcement of fake aliens, but that in actuality it's going to be an attempt to control the reality of actual non-humans who are here. In other words, control that from getting out and making it too much of a panic situation.
George, we don't believe that everybody's going to panic. I think the thing that we should all think about is if only 10%, let's say that 90% of the people handle this news in a reasonably responsible way, but 10% behave in unpredictable and in ways that are contrary to the public good. Well, that's a tremendous destabilizing amount of people that are off doing things they shouldn't be doing, and it's entirely possible. And it's funny, Rich, you were just talking about how you talk to people, and sometimes they give you that look. I was just at a family birthday party over the weekend, and I had my copy of the book delivered. And I was showing it to some people, and they were asking me, well, what is this about? And I was telling them, and honestly, I'd say I got the reaction from quite a few people that it was like I was the drunk uncle at the party.
Yeah.
who was like, when did he get that crazy? And so I think what's going to happen is the Coast to Coast listeners, for example, will be better prepared than most people by far. They won't be the people that are out panicking. They'll be the people saying, okay, well, let's get on with it now. Some of the people who are just, it's just too hard to get, wrap their brains around this possible reality. They may find themselves behaving in ways that are counterproductive, and I think that's going to be why we were breaking it down into the first seconds, the first minutes, the first hours. We tend to think the first year will probably be a pretty bumpy and disruptive ride, but as Rich is talking about, things will start to try to gel back together. But there is going to be some bumpiness here because it can't be any other way.
No. Look, no matter how well psychologically prepared people feel that they are for this, that's really only part of the issue. The largest part of the issue is going to be dealing with this institutionally. I mean, think about something like energy. All right, this is really, I think, the crux of the matter in terms of the UFO secrecy to begin with, because whatever these objects use to fly, it's not petroleum. And so when the reality is dropped and finalized and made official by some authority that, yes, this UFO reality is here, we're going to be asking, well, what's their source of power? And whatever that source happens to be, it's going to be threatening the world's largest industry, which is the petroleum industry. And so, you know, it's not just our form of energy that is petroleum-based. It's the entire global financial system, which in many ways is dependent upon petroleum in so many matters. So the aftershock, economically, financially, and in terms of energy transition, is going to be a very, very significant problem to manage for us as a society and for those people at the top to be able to continue maintaining their own position of power. That's only one issue, although it's a big one. What if, in terms of more of this technology coming out, what if one of the other secrets is some form of anti-gravity? That's great for us to be able to travel around the world if we have our own portable flying objects that can allow us to go anywhere. But it's an infrastructure disruption, at least in the short term, until we figure out how all of this is going to play out.
And it could be a huge one. I mean, you know, the stock market is closed on Friday when the announcement's made. It's going to open sometime, even if, as you speculate, the president suspends it for a while.
Right.
It reopens, it's going to drop. The energy sector, airlines, you speculate on, for example, would people be willing to fly on planes if they knew these flying saucers are real and are up there? Or would people not be driving to work? I mean, the repercussions, the ripples could be enormous.
Right now, we are aware, anyone who's researched into the phenomenon knows that there are so many aviation encounters with objects that just right now are not supposed to exist. And in a post-disclosure scenario, we're going to realize, oh, that's what they were. And so, yes, it's an air safety issue. Lawsuits, good grief. You know, you can imagine the class action lawsuits that are going to arise. People who've had abduction experiences, who've gone their entire lives in an isolated way, really afraid to talk about this to family members because they don't want to be perceived as the crazy person in the family, living sometimes in a post-traumatic scenario, they're going to be very angry. And I guarantee you they're going to be lawyers willing to take their case, and we'll start seeing some.
And in fact, we've talked to some of those lawyers. We spoke to one aviation law expert who makes his living on cases that deal with aviation law, and talked to that person. And one of the things he mentioned that we thought was very, very interesting is take just an example of a pilot that has potentially reported seeing a UFO and then finds his career path somewhat affected. That's going to be a lawsuit, among many other lawsuits. But clearly, one of the ways that we deal in our society with all kinds of issues, no matter how tragic, no matter how interesting, no matter what, many of our issues end up in court, and there's no way that the same will not be true for contact. Contact in some way is going to end up in court, and probably in many, many different ways.
Right. You also mentioned about truth commissions, investigations, inquiries, witch hunts, I guess. There'll be a lot of people trying to put the blame on somebody for us not knowing about it.
Well, one of the things that you have to ask yourself is there's so many institutions that have fumbled the ball on this. Take Congress, for example. These are the people that are supposed to represent the American people, and they have basically not held any substantial hearings at all. There were two that were held, but they weren't, and those were in the 60s, not great hearings. you could ask it, where were they on this issue? So when it becomes obvious that there's been disclosure, one of the things that they'll want to do is get involved to prove to their constituents that they're on top of it now. So there'll be some serious hearings, but then it becomes a house of cards. You have to ask yourself again, if you're having hearings and you're exposing wrongdoing, are we going to start putting people in jail over their role in keeping these secrets? And if we are going to start putting people in jail, for what crimes are we going to put them in? Are we going to let everything that they did become fair game? And at what point does that become counterproductive to society? Will there be a president who, for example, issues in some kind of blank pardon to get the country moving again? Say we do send truth commissions out based on how apartheid was handled in South Africa. What will be the impact of that? Are we then going to, again, start arresting people and putting them in jail? And we think at some point, short of treason or murder, most of those other secrecy-related crimes will probably have to be pardoned in order for society to start pulling itself together again.
There will be one area in which the official political window dressing establishment is going to bump up against something that's going to be a real knotty issue, and that's what we've called in our book the breakaway group, the breakaway civilization.
Yep, we're going to have to save that till after the break, though, because that's right. A whole different discussion. One thing I do want to get into as well is how other governments react. You know, you make the point in the book that other governments have sort of been waiting for us to take the lead on this in particular. I don't remember who the person is who made the contact with the Chinese government, but that the Chinese government has had a lot of information. They've been seeing this stuff and collecting information, but they won't talk about it publicly or make their own form of disclosure because they said they are waiting for the U.S. to take the lead. Is that right, Richard?
That's right. That's actually, that was C.B. Scott Jones who mentioned this publicly, and he was an aide for many years to Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island. This was during the 1990s when Pell was always interested in the UFO issue, and Jones was sort of an emissary. And this is what they told Scott Jones out in China. Yeah.
All right, we're taking a break. We will talk about the others, what reaction the others would have, as well as the breakaway group when we come back right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Gentlemen, let's talk for a minute about what you called the breakaway group. Richard, you think that there really is a group like this?
Yes, I do. I've been really working on this one for a couple of years, and think of it this way. Pretend it's 60 years ago, and we're part of the group that handles exotic, non-human made technology. So we were squirreled away in the clandestine world. We've got contractors looking at it, studying the technology. And it's difficult. It's hard to understand. It's so far ahead of us. But eventually, we've got a lot of smart scientists. They have their own various eureka moments and come up with all sorts of new ideas, whether that be the transistor or better integrated circuits or high tensile fibers or lasers or fiber optics and so forth. Now, those are all money-making opportunities, and that's important because that certainly takes their incentive away for wanting to give up this technology to the rest of the world. But now let's take it a step further and imagine that in addition to those things, they've developed other breakthroughs such as anti-gravity, maybe something like super longevity, if that's a possibility, who knows. Would they want necessarily to share those types of breakthroughs with the rest of the world? And we think the answer is certainly no. Anti-gravity, you release that to the world, you're taking down the petroleum industry, and there's no reason they're going to want to do that. Here's the thing about classified science is that it builds on itself. So that one breakthrough can very easily lead to another, which can lead to another. And the next thing you know, within the classified world, they could be many, many decades, generations ahead the rest of the world. We know this is already true regarding a lot of things like computing within the NSA. I spoke with an NSA scientist who told me back in the mid-60s their computers were running at a clock speed of about 650 megahertz. That's something that the modern the public did not reach until about the year 2000, so that's 35 years ahead. So the idea is that you have a group that's classified, that's in a separate reality in terms of their technology, and that allows them also to deal in a very hands-on way, probably, possibly, with these other beings who are interacting with us on this world right now. And so that, I think, could qualify them as a separate civilization or, as it were, a breakaway civilization with very, very different ideas about how this world is structured and set up in the cosmos itself. We believe that this is connected to the group known as Majestic, the group known as the Bilderberg Group, that these are interacting, interlaced types of entities. And it's going to be them that have the most knowledge, the most power in the at least immediate term when we're talking about a disclosure scenario. And these truth commissions that we've been talking about, also, it's going to be very difficult for them to avoid the fact that there's been this shadow government, shadow elite, yes, the Bilderbergers, yes, the people around men like David Rockefeller, okay, for all of these years, and Henry Kissinger, who have been in on this secret and who have been managing this. And the question will be, to the detriment of humanity, or are they doing it to try to help us out and to save us and to prevent us from panic? A lot of people are going to be very upset about this, obviously. And that is the group that we're talking about, this breakaway civilization.
And Bryce, do you need their permission to have any form of disclosure? Do they have to sign off on it before you do it?
Not necessarily. Let's walk this back for just a minute. You ask whether in fact there is such a thing, whether we believe there is such a thing. It's intuitive that there has to be something. You can't have a secret this large and sustained this long, have it ignored completely on a public level without it being managed in some way. So just logic tells you somebody's behind it. What they're called, whether they're called Majestic, whether they're called whatever, we decided that we should give it a name in the same way that we called them the others. So we have the Breakaway Group and the others. These are the two power groups, if you will, that are players in this game besides the public, the people who keep the secret and the people who are the secret. And to answer your question about whether you need their permission or whether they're involved, it kind of depends. I think over the years people have sort of assumed that these secret keepers would at some point make a decision to unveil what they were keeping as a secret. That's one way it could happen. Another way is that events could simply escalate so far out of control that they decide that they need to manage the revelation itself. They are, after all, people that have managed something pretty extraordinary for decades now, and they probably will not want to give up on their authority to try to manage things. I think, though, George, one of the things that we think is just fascinating as well is as when we talk about the two different power groups, the Breakaway Group, but then there's also the others.
Sure.
And it's very clear that the others are not likely to be the people or the group that is going to trigger disclosure, because they've had a long time. If they wanted to out themselves, they could have done it. People say, why don't they land on the White House lawn? Well, the fact is they haven't. So they could. They could have hovered spaceships over every major city like they did in Independence Day, but they haven't. But we think the one really interesting question that has not really been raised is this. If disclosure happens, for whatever reasons, and we as a humanity and as a human group begin to discuss this truth, this emerging truth, how will the others respond to us disclosing them to ourselves?
Well, I was going to ask you that. I mean, I wonder, and we're all speculating here, about how closely they monitor our communications, and could they even interpret the profound changes and level of discussion that would be happening if disclosure happened.
Right. Our suspicion is that they probably are pretty good at interpreting that. There's very good reason to believe that they've been interpreting us and managing us very possibly for a long time anyway. It's very possible. One of the whole chapters is that we spend is trying to understand who they might be. There's so many elements in this book to go through. It's almost impossible
I know.
To do it in any. But you know, are they from another planet? Are they from another dimension of reality? Are they from another time stream? Are they human-looking? Are they not human-looking? Are they artificially intelligent to some extent? Are they biological creations? All of these things are issues that Bryce and I really try to flesh out and think about. Certainly, it's quite possible that some of them might look just like us. Look, there's no shortage of stories within and claims within the UFO research field of entities that look very much like us, but that they don't act like us. And if that's so, that would tell us that they've got their own people, their own teams within our group right now, within our society now. And so they probably have a pretty good understanding of...
Well, that raises an interesting possibility of like a, and you address it in the book, of a possible... post-disclosure witch hunt, where everyone is wondering, hey, are you an alien? Are you one of them among us?
That's absolutely a chilling thought. And, look, disclosure is not going to be fun or easy. It can be a very, very messy, scary process. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, though. We feel it's an inevitable part of our trajectory as a society. And, yes, we're going to have to be very mindful of this. Neighbors turning on neighbors, people freaking out, buying up guns and ammo. You know, obviously that's going to be something that we're going to look at. The human looking ET scenario is going to be an issue, and there'll be religions that are going to come up like out of nowhere that are going to be dealing with a lot of these issues as well.
Stephen Greer would have his own church, right?
We'll let Greer answer that, okay? Why not?
The thing that that you raised there, though, Rich, and just talking about all the things that are covered in it, George, we tried to break this thing down in as many different ways as we could, and we started seeing so many institutions that will have to change or will be changed. We said that after 9/11, everything changed, and for a while, it felt like it did, but I think most of us would acknowledge that a lot of what happened afterwards has been pinging back to our sense of normalcy. But we think disclosure is going to be one of those everything changes moments. I mean, it's the biggest news ever, so it probably will merit that kind of discussion, and it's going to change everything. It's going to change government, science, religion, media, culture, law, education, politics, you name it. You talked before the break, about how will other people around the world deal with it. We want to make one thing very clear. We've been speaking about the United States. We've been speaking about the U.S. president. We've been talking about American institutions, but this is a global issue, and the interplay of disclosure is going to include people of every country. Every human being on the planet will be affected by it. And it is true that some countries are currently waiting for the U.S. to act, or it seems like the U.S. is the big brother in this group. But I don't know that we'll always feel that way. Maybe disclosure is going to come about, just to cycle this back to where we started when we were talking about an American president. It may very well be that another country is about to disclose, is about to just simply say, look, for better or worse, our investigation tells us that there's something going on here, and we're not going to be shy about talking about it. If the United States thought that was about to happen, we might very well not want to give up the control of the whole disclosure movement, and we might go first.
Exactly.
And then also you speculate, though, that we might view it as a hostile act on the part of that other government, whichever government it is.
Well, we might.
Sure.
I mean, just because the others are out there, and just because it's becoming more and more obvious to the world and some kind of disclosure needs to happen, doesn't mean that we suddenly, again, either all start singing Kumbaya or whatever. It means that we're going to continue to look at the world as we have, which is politically. And so governments are still going to have political issues with each other. Governments are going to have political issues with their citizens and with their representatives. None of that's going away. It's just going to be the current establishment that exists around the world is now going to have a new problem to deal with, which will be disclosure and how they're going to deal not just with the mere act of acknowledging that the others exist, but what it means to all these institutions I just named as to how they're going to process this information.
Richard, hasn't disclosure by other governments happened to one degree or another? They've opened up their files over the last couple of years, several major governments around the world?
It's happened, I would say, by drips and drabs, although those drips are becoming now a flow of water, so maybe not so much drips. But no, what the thing that has been lacking, though, of course, has been a definitive statement by a government. Yes, the British, the Ministry of Defense in Britain has released many of its files. Of course, what it hasn't released are its investigations. What it's released have been citizens, you know, writing in their sightings. Same with France, same with Norway. There have been national governments or national militaries that have made statements. Like Brazil has gone on the record and said a few things like, you know, we encountered these objects, we don't know what they are. But no one has really gone on the record to say, yes, people, it's real and they're here. No one's done that. They've always held back. And so no one has decided to take that sledgehammer and smash through the wall of truth on this matter. But certainly there's nothing stopping another country from doing that if they decided that it was going to be in their interest. I think the real upshot, I know we're getting toward the end here, of a post-disclosure scenario politically is going to be the issue of how we as a world are going to organize ourselves to deal politically in a rational and positive way with all of these multitudes of challenges that are going to be facing us, one of which I think we should have to put on the table is whether or not the official government of the United States, that is of the President and Congress, will try to take back power in the name of the American people from those elites that have been managing this process for all these years, that is the Breakaway Group, the Bilderberg Group, the people who basically put them into power in the first place. But will there come a moment in, say, the U.S. president's thinking where there's an opportunity to take a path of light, not the path of darkness, not a global police state, but rather a real opportunity for us to have an open public discussion, a public collaboration, a global talking to get together about this that really works in the public's interest, in the interest of the people? And one of the things that was very important to us in concluding this book was to point a direction, to show a way that it can be done in a positive way. And whether or not that happens is going to be another issue. Certainly there's all kinds of permutations out there, but we really believe that it is possible to work in a collaborative, global fashion to create a good scenario rather than a dark scenario.
One of the things toward the end of the book, you get into the possibility, and it's just a prediction, I understand, but about a new age of Aquarius. By the way, the E.T. Gray version of Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag, that was pretty funny. But this new age of Aquarius, sort of comparable to the post-JFK assassination, post-Vietnam, something like a return to the 60s. Now, I can hear the groans out there already. Bryce, why do you think that that is likely, and how would it change our everyday life?
Well, that's an example of where we're willing to be specific. It might not turn out that way, but if you think about what we're talking about, it's one of the most radical, revolutionary things that could happen, this announcement, and it's going to unleash forces of change. And what was triggered by the 60s, what triggered the 60s, rather, it was a couple of things. It was the assassination of the president, which was an incredibly destabilizing event, and it was also the sense that things weren't, as you quoted Robert Kennedy earlier, the world that he knew was not the real world. And I think those are the kind of things that cause people to try new ideas on. And certainly trying to incorporate into your culture the idea that contact has already occurred and has been occurring for decades and decades, and that not only are we not alone, but they're here now. These are revolutionary ideas. So the best analysis that we could come up with was culturally was we'll have something that feels like the 60s. We're not necessarily saying it's all going to be peace, love, and happiness and tie-dyed T-shirts, but we are saying that a radical impetus for change in our culture will occur, and the closest comparison that we can make in our contemporary times would be the 60s. The 60s stand out in our cultural memory because that was a time when society came a little bit unhinged. And notice that also what happened after the 60s is the 70s came, where there was kind of a pinging back. And so just in terms of looking at things and saying, are there lessons that can be learned from our recent history that we can apply to this situation, we think it's not a bad comparison. We think it's a good one.
Yeah.
Anything to add, Rich? We're about out of time here.
Well, you know, there's going to be massive upheaval in the world of science and in the world of religions. This was a very important chapter for us to work through. It was actually one of the most interesting, I think, for both of us personally, to try to puzzle through. How will the announcement of other beings affect the scientific community and the religious communities around the world, all of whom will interpret this in very, very different ways? And how will that affect the relationship of science to religion in general, that is, scientific versus, say, a spiritual orientation? This is actually one of the most fascinating issues, and it was one of the most fun for us to write about as well.
And literature and pop culture and the arts, painting,
absolutely.
All those would be affected as well, and you might have an explosion.
Yeah, I believe so. We believe that there will be the liberal arts, the sciences, all of them are going to be challenged, and we believe are going to rise to that challenge, and I think we'll be seeing new heights of human expression and understanding as well.
Creativity will be unleashed worldwide in a way that it never has been before. Because it will happen all at once, and it will happen in a world that, as we talk about, where news cycles are hours and not, you know, these days, and where information travels instantaneously. So it would be crazy to predict that it won't be that way.
And even if a lot of the news turns out to be negative, it really, that part's not going to matter. It's the shock of this newness that is going to spur our civilization, our race, onto some really new and amazing things.
Richard Dolan, always a pleasure to have you on. Always fascinating. Bryce Abel, nice to meet you on the air finally. I love the book, AD After Disclosure. I encourage people to take a look at it. Hope it was worth your time, fellas, to be on here.
Thanks so much for having us. It's terrifically an honor.
It was a great pleasure, George. Thank you.
Best of luck to you and your book. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Jacques Vallée, and I encourage you as well to check out his book, Wonders in the Sky. Happy Halloween, everyone. I'll be back next month. Good night.